Welcome to Engineering Science 216. Today, in Lecture 2, we're going to talk about the probes, the beams, and the waves that we use to accomplish characterization at the nanoscale. How we accomplish the touching, the seeing, the chemical detection, and hearing using probes, beams, and waves. So we're in Unit 2. We're now in Lecture 2. The use of probes, beams, and waves for characterization at the nanoscale. So the outline for this lecture is just some general comments, and then we're going to look at probes, photon beams, electron beams, and ion beams, and acoustic waves, and we're going to look at those from the perspective of how they allow us to characterize at the nanoscale, how they allow us to achieve touching, seeing, chemical determination, and hearing at the nanoscale. So last time we saw that some techniques were termed microscopies and some were termed spectroscopies. And what is the difference? Well, let's summarize what we decided. We decided that we were going to refer to microscopies as being those techniques that produce images. So ultimately, they are for seeing. There may be no photons ever used, except when our eye looks at some TV screen, some monitor screen. But they are ways of producing images. When a blind person uses Braille, they get an image, but there's no photons involved at all. So we're going to remember that in our microscopies, there may be photons involved, but most of the time at the nanoscale, there aren't, except when we look at that monitor. Spectroscopies, we agreed, were something or a technique where we measured energy or wavelength differences to deduce information. For example, they're used for chemical detection, and we saw some of that. We discussed it briefly. I also want to mention that frequently you will hear the term spectroscopy and the alternative term spectrometry. In today's world of technology and science, these two terms are often used interchangeably. Originally, they had a slightly different meaning, but today the terms are used interchangeably, and we will stay with the term spectroscopy. Let's talk about probes now. How do we use probes at the nanoscale? We saw a little bit of this briefly in Lecture 1, but let's look at it more closely. So we have a probe tip, and we've learned that in today's technology, this tip can be of the order of a fraction of a nanometer. It can be very, very small. This could end in a single atom, so it could be something like 0.2 nanometers in size down here. So we can make tips like that today. That could be a carbon nanotube, that whole probe. And so very, very, what is this? This is something of the order of several nanometers. So very, very fine probes that we have learned how to make. And we know that probe can interact with some surface. This is our surface here. It can interact with van der Waals forces, can interact with electrostatic forces, with various interatomic forces between the atoms of the probe and the atoms of the substrate. We've learned to make such very, very fine tips, and these probes then interact with the surface. We can make use these probes in a lot of other ways, as we'll discuss in a few minutes. So it's not just force interaction, like it's not just the way our fingers interact with a surface, which is strictly force, but we've learned to use these probes in a much more general way, a much more general way of touching the surface and being able to detect the presence of that surface. We'll get into that soon. So we have these very powerful probe tools, very, very small. The fact that they're so small means that we can interrogate a very, very small region. If this is small, then the region we're interrogating is very, very small. So we have the opportunity of getting information with very, very fine resolution. We can look at very, very fine parts of a surface. And then if we scan the probe back and forth, if we scan it back and forth across the surface, we can get information with very, very fine resolution, but across the entire surface. Very, very powerful. And again, as we said, we're going to generalize the interaction of the probe with the surface to not just include van der Waals forces, electrostatic forces, and interatomic forces, but we're going to look at a lot of other ways that a probe and a surface could interact. Therefore, look at a lot of other ways we can learn information with very fine resolution over an entire surface. Well, here is that beginnings of looking at some of these other ways. Here's a table where I've listed probe tools, and this table continues on, there's a lot of different probe tools, but we're going to talk about these. Let's begin with the contact profilometer. This is a very, very old tool. And the probes originally used in this technique were much bigger than this. The contact profilometer, the probe was about maybe a micron or 2 microns, something of the order of several microns, let's say 10 microns across, 2 microns across. Today, these probes for profilometry measurements can be down to 200 nanometers across. But they are not the very, very fine probes that we're going to be seeing soon. So with a profilometer, we can scan across the surface, we can think of that profilometer tip as being a stylus, like in a record player. So that stylus goes back and forth across the surface. We can then get a map of the surface profile. So it uses van der Waals forces, interatomic forces, electrostatic forces, and it gives us a trace. And if I go to here, I can see what kind of a trace I can get. The brown represents the actual surface, and you can see the probe or the stylus coming across, and the red represents the trace that the probe is able to produce. The movement of the probe up and down is converted via a mechanical system and electronics into a trace that shows up on a screen. So the red is the trace on the screen, and you can see how the features are converted into this trace. And you can see information is lost. You see the sharp peak, it doesn't show up here. That's because of the size of the stylus. You can see that, for example, the trace is nowhere near as deep as the actual feature because the stylus can't get down here. So the profilometer gives you, it's a very common tool. It's a quick way of looking at the surface features. Certainly not with the resolution that is possible with other probe tools. The next tool that we'll look at is sort of the cousin of the contact profilometer, but a very famous cousin, and that's the atomic force microscope. And it comes in several varieties: the contact type, the non-contact type, the dynamic contact, the tapping, all different ways of accomplishing atomic force microscopy. We'll discuss those later in the course as we look at uses of atomic force microscopy. But once again, it uses the forces that you would expect. It can generate then very, very detailed information because the probes used are nanoscale probes. They're these probes that we talked about where this feature is of the order of several nanometers, or maybe even a fraction of a nanometer. In fact, that probe could be a carbon nanotube. And so a lot of information is possible. If we look at the electrostatic force microscope, then we can, using electrostatic forces, get another picture of the surface with strictly electrostatic forces. We can go to a magnetic force microscope. And in that case, the probe is a tiny nanoscale magnet. And that is used to scan the sample and detect magnetic interaction. And the strength of that magnetic interaction can then be converted into an image. So it gives us an image. That's why we call it a microscopy. These references, by the way, are on this table that I've included. And so you can go to this table and look into some of these references just to get started. These are very, very popular techniques, very powerful techniques, and these are just introductory references. There are many, many references in the literature if you wish to look further into these different types of probe techniques. Another probe technique is a piezoelectric response force microscopy. So let's see, what's piezoelectricity? Piezoelectricity is when you press on something, it creates a charge. Piezo is Greek for press or pressure. So it's a pressure response. So if you press on something, it creates a charge. If you press back and forth, then the charge becomes a current. Alternatively, you can use a current to cause a piezoelectric to deform. So it's a reversible process. So you can use an alternating current between the tip and a ferroelectric, that is a piezoelectric, to excite deformation. So you can cause the tip, you can set things up so that the tip causes deformation. And you can measure that deformation and thereby measure the electrostatic forces. So you can measure the mechanical properties of the material. Another interesting probe technique is scanning capacitance microscopy. That uses one of these tiny nano probes that we discussed and looks at the capacitance between the probe tip and the surface, the region right underneath the surface. And it can look at the variation of that capacitance across the sample to generate an image. These are all microscopy, so with the help of our computer programmer, everything can be turned into an image on a screen. Kelvin probe force microscopy is another technique for imaging a surface. This actually can be used to measure work function as a function of position, which can be extremely interesting. If you remember, when you have two materials, let's draw a Venn diagram here. Material 1 with a Fermi level up here, material 2 with a Fermi level down here. This is a vacuum. The distance down to the Fermi level is called the work function. Well, I have work function differences here. If one of these is the probe and the other is the surface, then this work function difference will cause a current to flow. And I can use that to develop an image of the surface, from which I can also extract the work function difference. So it's a work function difference between the tip and the surface. Hopefully I know the work function of the tip, therefore I can deduce the work function of the surface as a function of position. It generates this information under thermodynamic equilibrium. Because if you remember from Venn diagrams, when you put materials together with different work functions, current will flow to try to make sure that the Fermi level is at the same level. In this case, current will flow to put negative charge over here and positive charge over here. So that's what you're measuring, that current flow. And you can use it to figure out more current flow, obviously. Well, more current flow, the bigger the difference. And so from that, you can figure out the work function difference, and you can do this as a function of position. Kelvin, Lord Kelvin, my goodness, 150 years ago, thought about this kind of measuring tool. He didn't think about making it into tiny nanoscale probes, but he thought about it at his size scale, our size scale. We also have a chemical force microscope, and that measures van der Waals forces and interatomic forces, and it can measure chemical bonding. And I believe I have a picture of that. Yes, here it is. This is a chemical force microscope. So what's happened on the, in this case is that there's some molecule. Here you can see this is a monolayer. Looks like it's a self-assembled monolayer on the surface. And then I have a probe, and it's been functionalized, as you see here, with another molecule. And so by bringing this probe with this other molecule very close to the surface that has this SAM on it, I can measure the forces between the molecules of the probe and the molecules of the surface. So I can measure what we call, well, I'm measuring interatomic forces, van der Waals forces, interatomic forces. But on a macroscopic scale, that's what we call adhesion and friction. What is friction? It's this van der Waals forces, interatomic forces, if you look at it at the nanoscale. What's adhesion? It's just van der Waals forces and microscopic, interatomic forces and maybe electrostatic forces, if you look at it at the nanoscale. So you're measuring these and you're looking at this interaction. Very, very powerful to look at the interaction between these two molecules. Here's your probe. You would have laser light coming down, hitting the probe, going up, and then being analyzed, turned into an image. And as the force gets stronger, the probe bends down closer. As the force gets weaker, the probe comes up, springs back up. All of that is picked up by the laser beam. All the deflections picked up, and then with our computer, the scientist friend again, that's turned into an image. So that's a chemical force microscope. As we said, it can measure chemical bonding. That bonding, of course, leads to friction and adhesion if we use terms that we use at our scale. But, of course, friction and adhesion, as we said, are really van der Waals forces and interatomic forces. There's the scanning electrochemical microscope. And that measures oxidation reduction currents. Oxidation is taking an electron away, reduction is putting it back. So you can have reactions going on. Well, you have a tip, the surface, then you have a surface, and you induce or you select the tip, the materials, so that you can drive either a redox, that is the tip injects an electron into here, or an oxidation, the tip takes an electron out. You can induce an oxidation reduction reactions. And of course, if the tip sucks an electron out, that is, if it oxidizes the surface, then that electron has to go around in an external circuit. So you can measure the currents, you can then look at oxidation reduction reactions for catalysts, for enzymes. You can look at a lot of interesting biological and physical surfaces and look at their chemistry. And with spatial resolution that's extremely small, as you know. Another type of probe microscopy is spreading resistance microscopy. And spreading resistance is an old technique, again, it's been around for about maybe 50 years, and it uses current to measure resistance and thereby to deduce resistivity. From resistivity, if you're dealing with semiconductors, you can deduce doping. What's been done here is to take this technique that's rather old, but then use a probe to do the actual measurement. So once again, the power of the probe is used here, these nanoscale probes, and the nanoscale probe is used to map across the surface, and with electronics that's used to, in this case, not give an image, but to give a resistance picture, which shows the resistance as a function of position. Once you know the resistance, there's been some modeling done, again, from about 50 years ago that shows that if you know the resistance, you can deduce the resistivity from this formula. The resistivity, if you multiply the resistance that you measure by 4 times the radius of the probe, you can get the resistivity. So you can actually get the resistivity of the region. Once you have the resistivity, you have a very good picture of the surface. Again, not a physical picture, but a data picture. Here you see the resistivity as a function of position. It's different here than it is here, than it is here. Well, you can see, let's see. Red is the resistivity. So you can see the different resistivities. But then you can convert it to, this is a semiconductor, so you can convert it into carrier concentration. And from carrier concentration, you can convert it into doping. So you can actually look at the doping profile across a structure with extremely fine resolution. So very, very powerful technique for looking at doping profiles. So obviously of importance to engineers in making transistors to find out if the doping occurred to the degree they wanted, if it occurred where they wanted it to occur. Very, very powerful technique. Again, here's a reference if you want to look into that further in the reference sheet. Scanning tunneling microscopy, again, another famous type of microscopy. I'm giving you a lot of different microscopies here so you can see what the probe has generated, all these different techniques. Scanning tunneling microscopy, of course, relies on quantum mechanical phenomena of tunneling. And that tunneling current then can be used to generate an image of an actual picture. The limitation of tunneling microscopy is that the surface must be a conductor. Yeah, here's a picture of scanning tunneling microscopy, a cartoon. So here's your very fine nanoscale probe. Here's the atoms. And let's say this is a conductor, so we have a chance of this thing working. So when the probe gets close to the atoms, then the idea of tunneling can take place. Tunneling is an effect where if you have an atom here, I'm going to draw atoms with a simple square well. And here's an atom over here. The electrons here, this is the atom of the tip. This is the surface. The electron here can't get to here because this is a forbidden region. It's a barrier. But in quantum mechanics, if these get close enough, the psi waves, a quantum mechanical wave, can leak out over here and the electrons show up over here. That's tunneling. It's an electron, or any particle, going through a classically forbidden region. Well, the tunneling works. You can actually use it to profile a surface. So it's not a question of whether it works. It's a very practical tool for profiling surfaces, getting images. Only works for conductors, as we said. But here is a picture of a surface done with a tunneling electron microscope. And you can actually see the atoms here. You can see the beautiful crystal structure. You know, when people tell you that the atoms in a crystal are arranged like this, you wonder, you know, is it really true? Well, and this is a cut taken in a certain direction. I don't know what direction. But you can see the atoms are beautifully arranged. But you can also see with this powerful technique that there's some atoms missing. There's some mistakes here. Nature's made some errors here, some mistakes. So you can actually detail the information. Take a look at the surface. Let's go back to the table. And spin polarized scanning tunneling microscopy. This is another technique that relies on quantum mechanical tunneling, but it also relies on spin. If you remember, an electron has mass, it has charge, and it's also a little magnet. And the orientation of its magnetization is called spin. So it uses tunneling with a magnetized tip, so our tip is magnetized. and electrons in the sample with spins matching the tip's magnetization. So you need a tip that's oriented the same way as the electrons, and when that happens, then the electrons can tunnel through easily, and that gives you a current. So this actually operates, this tip in the surface operates as a spin valve. For electrons that have their magnetization oriented the same way as the tip, they can get through. Others can't get through very easily. So you can actually image the surface this way, and you can get a picture of the surface as well as magnetization, magnetic information. So the next technique is a photon scanning tunneling microscopy. My goodness, look at all these different ways these probes are being used. And look at all the ideas that, you know, we've come to feel hopefully comfortable with, spins and tunneling and photons and what have you, and how they're being used. Those ideas are all being used in a very practical way to be able to image materials at the nanoscale, to make better transistors, to make better sensors, to make better materials of all kinds, to understand cancer and what's going on in cancer cells. And all that is being done because of all these techniques that we've developed. And we're able to do it because we understand this rich physics, and we're exploiting the physics with these probes to learn more about, to characterize better surfaces. So this photon scanning tunneling microscopy uses what's called a near-field optical wave and photon tunneling. So when you talk about light impinging on a surface, and then the light comes back, we usually talk about the light back here far from the surface. That's called the far field. What happens when you think of the light as a wave? We're going to think of the light as a wave. So it comes in and it sets up what's called a near field here. And we haven't really known too much about near fields until we got computers and could, except in special cases, with computers we could actually solve for this near field and see what it looks like. So today we're very capable of knowing what the near field looks like when a light wave comes in. So here comes the light wave in, and we understand the far field, the light wave bouncing back out. But the near field is that interaction region with the surface. We now understand it very well because we have computers that can solve Maxwell's equations. Those are the governing equations for all electromagnetic phenomena. We can solve Maxwell's equations in that region, see what things look like, we can then have a very good picture of the near field. Well, what happens here in this technique is we use the near field as a way to allow photons to tunnel out of the surface of the material, and we collect those photons to get an image. So a near field is created at the surface, and photons tunnel from the surface. We had electrons tunneling a couple of minutes ago. Now we have photons tunneling from the surface to the probe. So they tunnel from the surface to the probe. Those photons go to a detector that produces an output signal. And then we use our computer programmer person again to turn that the number of photons collected into a picture. Here it is here. So we have the incoming light coming in. Oh, I'm sorry, no. We have the incoming light coming in here and bouncing off. We have a near field set up. This is the incoming light. We have a near field set up here, and then we collect any photons that come off and here we multiply, use those photons and we multiply them. Here we have some electronics for feedback. I'll talk about that in a minute. And here our computer friend turns that into a picture. So light coming in, creating a near field, then collecting the photons and turning that into a picture. The piezo electric transducer comes back and forth. We can, to a very fine degree, control the distance of the tip from the surface. These piezoelectric transducers are very important in probe technology because they can very precisely position the probe. And of course, we can scan this probe to get a full picture of the surface. Going back to my table, we can also use heat to get a picture, and that would be the scanning thermal microscopy. So heat flows from the tip to the sample to create a temperature and or thermal conductivity map of the sample. So we use the flow of heat. We can also have photothermal microscopy, where we use infrared photons, then use these infrared photons to get imaging information to get heating information from the surface. So we use the probes to detect the temperature. We use near-field scanning optical microscopy, and in this case, it's once again using the near-field, and we collect the near-field, because remember, the near-field is very sensitive to the surface. The far-field is what we're used to. Here's the far-field out here. Light comes in, bounces out. We're used to that light that's bouncing out here. The near-field exists over in nanometer range. And we use that near field information to get a picture of the surface. And again, all of these have acronyms. This particular one's called NSOM. And it's a very powerful technique. So in this case, you have a probe, and you have the light coming in. You see the very, very small region where you have the near field. We have the diffraction limit with light. You know that. Diffraction limit makes it very hard for us to see very small objects. But the near field is very, very small. And if we collect information from the near field, we can actually sidestep the diffraction limit and actually get information on the details of the surface using optical microscopy, a special type of optical microscopy, near-field scanning optical microscopy. If we go back to our table, these are all the references that I have for you if you want to explore any of these in more detail. We have Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy. The Fourier transform part, we can really forget about that. Not forget about it, but we can de-emphasize it because that's a mathematical technique used to sharpen up the data. The important thing is it's an infrared spectroscopy. And so what you're doing is you use a tip to allow infrared light to come to a very small region. So you have the tip, your infrared light comes down, and that infrared light excites vibrational modes in the molecules in the bonding of the solid below. And vibrational modes, what I mean by that is you can think of the atoms of the material as being held together by springs. So when the infrared light comes in, it turns out that the energy of the photons of infrared light corresponds very closely to the energy needed to get these springs bouncing back and forth. So in other words, you can excite vibrations by sending infrared light in. You can excite the vibrations of the molecules. And which vibrations you excite tells you what atoms or what molecules were present. I think I have, and by the way, since you used the probe, you have a very, very small region that you're looking at, and you can scan the surface. And this is a spectroscopy because we're trying to get detailed information, not necessarily an image. Yes, here, this shows the near field, the light coming in, light bouncing all around here, but collecting information. See the probe is collecting light from the near field region, therefore giving information on the surface. So we're going to put our probe on the surface. We're going to shine down infrared light. We're going to excite vibrational modes in the material, and we're going to use that as a spectroscopy. At the same time, we can also use that probe to create an image using, we could just use atomic force microscopy mode to create an image. In any case, we can get an image, so we know with the probe, so we know what we're looking at. And what we're looking at is material B sitting on top of material A. And we would like to know what they are. So by looking at what happens when this probe is over here on material A and the infrared light's coming down, it excites vibrational modes that we identify with these bonding configurations. Look at this. This can tell the difference between carbon-carbon oxygen and carbon-oxygen-carbon. So this is all known information. It's all information that is cataloged. And sample B, we find out actually is a little speck of a material that has silicon in it. And you can see that these are different silicon bondings. This material turns out to be PMMA, which is a photoresist, and this material turns out to be PDMS, which is, of course, a very interesting type of, can be used as a photoresist also, a very interesting type of material. So we can get extremely detailed chemical information, and notice that this is 200 nanometers, so this whole thing is about 200 nanometers wide, this speck, and we can pick up the difference in the chemistry here and the chemistry here. Very interesting information. So if we go back to our table, we have completed the table, but we haven't completed all the probe techniques. There are more. This table is not intended to be all-inclusive. It is offered to you with the hope that it will give you a feel for how wide the spectrum of probe tools is, and you'll see all the different rich physics that's used to map out surfaces, and you'll see how we can create images in various ways, but you'll also see how we can get very, very interesting information, chemistry, magnetic properties, mechanical properties, at an incredibly fine resolution. Very, very powerful techniques. Let's talk about some photon beam tools. So we're going to shoot a beam of photons in. Raman spectroscopy is one type of tool. We shoot light in. Well, we need to think about it as a particle, a photon. So we think of the light. Remember, we have to be able to switch back and forth. As Einstein said, these are models, and sometimes we have to use one or the other to better understand things. So we're going to shoot a photon in, and we're going to interact with the vibrational modes, but we're going to think of the vibrational modes in terms of their quanta, which are the phonons. So the way Raman spectroscopy works is a photon comes in, has a collision with a phonon, and the phonon changes the energy, more importantly, changes the momentum of the photon, thereby changing its wavelength, thereby changing the color that the eye will perceive that photon as, or a detector will perceive that photon as. This technique is very good for looking at structure, bonding structure. So, for example, I personally used it to determine whether a silicon film is crystalline, polycrystalline, or amorphous. It's very powerful for techniques such as that. So, once again, we have to be very knowledgeable about things like photons and phonons and understand this technique and what it can do. Here is a beam of red photons. You know, the photons aren't really red, but that's, if those photons hit your eye, that's what your brain would say is the color that you see. So they're coming in and they're interacting with the sample, and the phonons that are in the vibrational modes are changing the wavelength of the light, and that's picked up by a detector. So just to summarize this, our picture of the universe and how we're using it here, electromagnetic radiation comes in packets called photons. Vibrational phenomena come in packets called phonons. And in some situations, here's one, they can interact phonon with photon with phonon, and we can treat it very accurately as a collision, and we can see that the phonon of the vibrational mode has affected the photon wavelength. As you see here, the color change. And that constitutes detection. And the phonon, of course, comes from the vibrational mode, and the vibrational modes are different depending on whether a solid is crystalline or amorphous. So immediately one can see how this can give structural information. It can give other information also, but that's a good example of kind of information you can get. Photoelectron spectroscopy, that uses a photon beam that comes in. And we talked about this a little bit in lecture one. It also has another name, photoemission spectroscopy. So you have a beam of light coming in, and it excites electrons that come out. And then we, by analyzing those electrons that come out, we can learn about the energy levels in the solid and thereby learn about the composition of the solid. Here is the photons coming in. You see the photoelectrons coming out. We analyze the energy of the photoelectrons, and from that we can determine what is the composition of the surface. And we use an ultra-high vacuum so that we don't have an impurity problem. And X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy. In this case, we're going to use the particle nature of electromagnetic phenomena, and we're going to go way over to the extremely high energy photons of the electromagnetic spectrum, which are the X-rays or the gamma rays. We'll think about X-rays, and these X-rays will come in and they excite the material we're trying to analyze. And then the energy levels, of course, there's characteristic energy levels of the material, and we'll see fluorescence coming off, which will be the fingerprint of what the constituents of the solid are. So here comes the high energy photon in. It's a high enough energy that it can promote electrons to higher energies inside the solid. By the way, in an atom, we know that the energy levels are, hydrogen is, somewhere around, my goodness, I forget, but somewhere around 10 eV deep, where the atom is. But in solids, this can be thousands of electron volts deep. So that's why you need a high energy photon, so you can promote these electrons up. You can put a lot of energy into the material, then the material will start relaxing. So, for example, so you put the photon in, it promotes the electrons up. These electrons have excited the material. The material might start relaxing, so this might fall down, for example, and the photon come off. That tells you about the state, which then helps you learn about the constituents. So when that electron falls down, that's called fluorescence, because it happens at a certain time after the actual photon's promoting of the electron up here. It's a fluorescence process. It's a relaxation process. So that completes the photon techniques that I happen to list. It's not all-inclusive by any means, but it gives you some flavor. Some light wave tools, in other words, we think of light as a wave. Well, the fluorescence microscopy, I talked about that before, where you use light. It can be in the visible range. It can be ultraviolet. It comes in. It excites molecules. And these molecules are far apart. There's only a few of them, but you excite them and the light comes off, and therefore you can locate the molecules, you can actually learn information about the molecules. So here's a fluorescence microscope. It's using light in the visible range, often uses ultraviolet, close to the visible range. And then here is a surface. You see that we're looking at this very fine region here. If we look at it, we can look at it with a very fine resolution, and we see these molecules. And here's two molecules that are only 15 nanometers apart. So we're actually looking at the molecules. We're seeing the surface at this kind of resolution, even though we're using visible light. We're seeing this particular molecule, which is in human cancer cells. We're seeing where it's located, its spacing, what have you, inside the cell. We have Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy. We just talked about that. We talked about it in the context of there being a probe. It doesn't have to be a probe. IR can come in as a broad wave, it can interact with the surface, it can excite vibrational modes, and we can learn about the chemical constituency of the surface. The disadvantage of this is we don't have the spatial resolution. We have a surface and the wave is coming in all over. If we use a probe, then we have a surface and we have a very fine probe and we're just looking at a very small region. But in this case, I'm talking about, in general, this technique. It works, as does the fluorescence microscopy, with the wave properties of light. Here is just to further discuss the infrared spectroscopy. Remember, that's exciting vibrational modes, bonds, and this is a table that shows you some groups, and this is where these are the frequencies of the vibrational modes. These are given in wave numbers. Wave number is 1 over the wavelength, which is sort of like the frequency. It's 1 over the wave number. So these are wave numbers. So you're seeing where the wave numbers are excited, where you get a peak with that kind of bonding when you started vibrating, where you get a peak with this kind of bonding, where you get it vibrating with the benzene ring, where the peak's expected with the benzene ring. Very, very powerful. Why use infrared? Because the photons of infrared match with the vibrational modes, match with the energy of the vibrational modes, match with the, are able to excite these vibrational modes. Let's talk about some phonon tools. The phonons are the quantum of the vibrational mode. Obviously, Raman. We just went over Raman, so I won't dwell on this at all, but this is just one where a characterization technique where you obviously use the phonon properties of acoustic vibrations. Again, this is not an all-inclusive table, but meant to show you how even phonons can be very valuable. Again, we looked at this earlier with a probe so we can get really good spatial resolution, but it doesn't have to be used with a probe. Some acoustic wave techniques. Again, we've already talked about this, but I'll mention it again. The acoustic wave microscope. Remember, that uses the near field to overcome diffraction. Remember, acoustic waves are waves. They also have quanta. But here, we always have to worry about the wave properties when it comes to diffraction limit. We can use a near field to overcome diffraction limit of acoustic waves, And these are turn out to be very powerful for studying elastic properties of materials. That's how it's used. Here's an acoustic wave tool. In this case, it's shown in a probe configuration. So again, here's the probe. The laser is being used to bounce off the probe to get the position of the probe. And saw waves are propagating down a surface. Saw stands for surface acoustic wave. Surface acoustic wave. So this is a transducer which generates surface acoustic waves. The probe picks up the acoustic wave propagating down the surface. There can be some mixing. And from that, you can get some interaction, and the interaction, what comes out, tells you about the mechanical properties of the surface. Some ion beam tools. We can use the ion microscope. We know there's electron microscopes. There's all kinds of electron microscopes, scanning electron microscope, field emission scanning electron microscope, transmission electron microscope. We'll be talking about those later in the course, but in this introduction, let's go to the ion microscope. It's less common. It's newer. Yeah, it uses the wave property of particles to overcome diffraction, and it does that through the de Broglie limit. In other words, light has a certain energy. We know that, the spectrum. Electrons have certain energies, which depends on their mass. Light has certain wavelengths, which depend on their energy and their mass. And ions have certain wavelengths, which depend on their energy and their mass. The heavier the mass, the smaller the wavelength. So with ions, you can overcome the diffraction limit because the wavelength is so small that the wavelength is small compared to the features you're interested in, so you don't have any diffraction problems. And so you can overcome the diffraction limit. By the way, the wavelength of light doesn't surprise us. We're comfortable with that. But the wavelength of electrons and the wavelength of ions is something we have to work with. As we know, we can go back to what Einstein said, which we discussed in the first lecture. We have to work with it. This is how we can understand wave phenomena, both particle and packet properties. And for particles, the wavelength is called the de Broglie wavelength, named after the French physicist who first proposed this duality of waves having particles and particles having waves. And so for the electron and the ions, we have these waves, and since mass is involved, we can have some very small wavelengths for ions. So very, very powerful for diffraction. So yes, we have electron beam microscopies, and we'll talk about those more in the course, but the ion microscopy is very, very powerful. And here's a picture of an ion microscope. We used this picture before, but I think it's very good, and let's just review that the ions that we use come into here as a gas. They're converted to ions, so commonly helium is used, but we can use other gases. The ion beam comes down. We can deflect it, move it back and forth with electric fields. And then it comes down and we can collect the ions come off, and those ions then can give us an image of the surface, which we can display. We can also collect the electron image if we want. Secondary ion mass spectroscopy is also on our table. It just relies on particle bombardment. And it uses ions to sputter a surface. Sputtering, as we have said, and I think in lecture one, we hit a surface with ions, it knocks some of the ions off, and so we can actually make a crater with sputtering. So it sputters some ions off the surface, so we can make a crater, we can actually etch with the ions, but we can also collect the ions and use them. And in secondary ion mass spectroscopy, we collect the ions and we analyze those ions to find out what is the composition of this material. So here with a picture, I show secondary ion mass spectroscopy, also affectionately known as SIMS. In fact, you hear most people just call it SIMS. And so you have primary ions coming in. You can see they could be things like oxygen or argon or cesium. And they come in and they knock ions off, and that signal that is knocked off is these secondary ions, hence the name secondary ions, are used to analyze the composition. It's a spectroscopy because you're not trying to get a picture. You're trying to find out how many of different kinds of ions are coming off, thereby getting the composition. And the reason you use different charges of the ions, here's O plus and here's O minus, is that ions with different charges will interact with the material differently, so you can knock off different ions more effectively, making sure you're getting a complete picture of the composition of the surface. So we have taken a look at characterization at the nanoscale. And we have thought about, okay, how do we actually accomplish at the nanoscale seeing and touching and chemical analysis and hearing? How do we accomplish those things at the nanoscale? And we've gone over the use of probes to accomplish those characterization tasks. We've gone over the use of photon beams, electron beams, ion beams. We've talked about the wave properties of light and the photons, of course, as we said. We've talked about acoustics, both the waves and thinking of vibration, mechanical vibration modes, which is what acoustics is, in terms of their quantum, which is the phonon. We've looked at all those things. So we've looked at probes, photon beams, electron beams, ion beams, and acoustic waves. We've looked at how all of those can be used for characterization at the nanoscale. Now we're going to go into a series of lectures where we talk about using these different tools to characterize materials and structures.